Hey, I'd like to call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It's 1:02 PM. Today is Monday, April 22nd. The members present are Representatives Hannan, Rasmussen, Vice Chair Hopkins, Co-Chair Tarr, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Please let the record, actually, we do have a quorum, so please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business, and please silence your cell phones before we get started. We have two items on the agenda today, finishing the presentation on Alaska Oil and Gas Production Tax, and then House Bill 122. And we'll first take up the presentation. So Mr. Stickle, is that, if you want to join us, please put yourself on the record.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Revenue Economist with Department of Revenue, and I believe we will be joined at some point here by the Commissioner on the phone from Anchorage.
Okay. We're on slide 16. Is that where we left that?
15. Yes, sir. So in the previous hearing, we had gone through the sources of oil and gas revenue to the state and a detailed walkthrough of the oil and gas production tax as shown here on slide 15. I believe we left off at the end of this slide. So slide 16 then is a five-year comparison of the production tax calculation for North Slope oil and gas. We have 2 years of actual analysis for fiscal year 17 and 18, as well as fiscal year 2019, which is the current year that ends on June 30th, and then the 2 years of forecast, fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 2021. You see here production tax value was a little under $2.2 billion in fiscal year 2017, increased to $4.9 billion in fiscal year 2018, and has been around $5 billion in 2019 through 2021 as our forecast. In fiscal year 17, all companies were paying at or below the minimum tax, the gross minimum tax, given the low oil prices and the relatively low production tax value. In fiscal year 18, we had some companies that paid just above the minimum tax and some companies that paid at the minimum tax. Going forward, several of the major producers are expected to pay above the minimum tax in fiscal year 19 and beyond, as you can see with the actual tax after credits being above that minimum tax calculation. And so that concluded that was the last slide of the original presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. And I believe you had some questions from committee members that you were able to look into since the last time we met.
Yes, sir. So we have two addendums to the slide deck. First is an addendum that we had in the original presentation, and then the second is an addendum of follow-up questions from the April 15th hearing. So the first addendum, beginning on slide 19, we were asked to, by the committee and other interested parties, to show an analysis of the distribution of cash flows from North Slope oil production, also referred to as government take or company take. The basis for this analysis is cash flows to the industry after subtracting all transportation costs and lease expenditures. So essentially we're looking at what is the pie of cash flow on the slope and how is that pie distributed amongst the different stakeholders. And so there's two ways that we look at this. One is we model a typical non-gross value reduction eligible field. So this is your fields like your Prudhoe Bays, your Kuparex, Endicott's, things like that. And say for one of these typical fields with typical costs, how are the cash flows distributed? And then a second way of looking at the analysis that yields slightly different results is to look at it from an industry-wide perspective for the entire slope, include all production and spending. So in the second set of analysis, we're also including gross value reduction, eligible production, that's the new fields and the lower tax that they pay, and then we're also including spending on exploration and development projects. So slide 20, starting with your typical non-gross value reduction production, this slide just outlines some of the assumptions that we've made to do this analysis. This is a standard analysis that we've presented for many years, including before and during the debates about enacting the current tax law. So we're looking just at fiscal year 2020 data per the spring revenue forecast. We're assuming a single company for this analysis and that all production is non-GVR production. One of the important changes that was made in the most recent analysis compared to in the past is the federal corporate income tax rate. The federal tax change reduced the marginal rate from 35% to 21%. That's been a material change for the attractiveness of investment all across the United States. So slide 21 then, and I should point out there's a note at the bottom that here that says revised from 4/15/19 version. In the original slide deck that we presented to the committee, we had these slides. There was a slight error in the calculations on slide 21 and 22. Those have been fixed in the version before you today. But this chart on slide 21 shows where the cash flows from a typical barrel of non-GVR production go. This is based on our spring forecast of $66 ANS price. You'll see that for a typical barrel of production, costs account for about half of the value of the oil. This is transportation costs as well as lease expenditures. Of the remaining, the state and municipalities get about 35%. This includes royalty and the entire property tax payment. The federal government gets about 14% of the profit. This is the 21% marginal corporate income tax rate. And the producers get about 51%. And keep in mind, this is 51% of the cash flow left over after all costs are incorporated. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, the producer share is a little higher than what we've seen in previous analysis in previous years. The federal corporate income tax change is a significant contributor to that. Also, reduced costs. The lease expenditures have come down quite a bit in recent years as the producers have worked to make Alaska production economic at lower oil prices. And so that has also improved the economics of the production on the slope. Moving on to slide 22, this is the same information from the previous slide, but showing the distribution of cash flows across a range of different prices from $40 to $130 per barrel of ANS. As you'll see, at lower prices, the state share is quite a bit higher due to some elements of our fiscal system being fixed, such as the property tax, or based on gross value, such as the royalty or the production tax when companies are paying under the minimum tax. So for a typical non-GVR field, the government take is 82% at $40 per barrel and then 58% at $130 per barrel. And again, we're currently in this $60 to $70 range currently and then over the next several years of our forecast. Moving on to slide 23, this is the similar analysis to what we just showed, but now we're looking at all slope-wide production and costs. So we're including the impacts of special tax provisions for new fields under the GVR deduction and the different per taxable barrel credit for those fields. We're also including all slope-wide costs in this analysis. So those companies that are that have exploration and development going on and might not be paying tax presently, we're kind of putting that all together to give an industry-wide view of what the distribution of cash flows look like. So slide 24 shows where the cash flows go for a typical barrel when we're including all of the exploration and development costs. The costs portion of this is a little bit higher, so the cash flows available for the different stakeholders is a little bit lower. Under this analysis, the state and municipalities get about 38% of cash flows. The federal government gets about 13%, and the producers get about 49% of the cash flow. And then once again, slide 25 shows the analysis at a range of prices, and you'll see at lower prices, when you look at the industry as a whole, the state actually takes more than 100% of the profit. Again, that's due to you have gross value-based royalty and minimum production tax and property tax offsetting a smaller amount of cash flow available for distribution. And this is an interesting point because over the next several years of our revenue forecast, we're actually forecasting significant increases in industry spending on new developments on the slope. And so this trend you see here will actually be exacerbated in the next several years. And so, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the first addendum.
Okay. So a little bit of housekeeping. So Representative Tallarico would join us at about 1:05 p.m. Rep. Sponholz at 1:10 p.m. Commissioner Tangeman is on the line, as well as Colleen Glover with DOR to answer any questions that the committee members might have. And Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Stickel, your last statement where you said that trend will continue, and I thought I was following you, but I didn't see that trend continuing in those bar graphs. So could you expand upon your last point?
Sure. Representative,
I thought I was following, but then I didn't see the trend.
Representative Hannon, through the chair. So the point I was making was comparing slide 22 at the lower price here to slide 25, and the fact that the government takes a higher share of profit at low prices when you're looking at North Slope industry as a whole, including exploration and development costs. And so we're forecasting significant billions of dollars of additional capital expenditures in the 2021 through 2024 timeframe as companies spend to bring on new developments such as Willow and Pikka. So we have major new spending. So when you look at a industry-wide standpoint, the pie of distributable income will be smaller if you're factoring in those expenses for exploration and development. But at the same time, the state continues to have a gross-based royalty and a fixed property tax.
Can I follow? And I may have these flip through the chair. One of those fields is not on state land at all. Is it Willow or is it that's on federal land in the NPRA? So we allow the deduction of the expenditures, but we're not, what do we get in return for that? We get royalty only? But we would get no production tax off of those federal properties. Is that correct?
Sure. Representative Hannon, through the chair, production tax actually applies on all state land, all land within the boundaries of the state of Alaska and up to the 3-mile limit offshore. We get a share of royalty. And actually, in our second addendum, I have a slide that breaks down which taxes and royalty provisions apply by which land types. That might be okay. Helpful to that question.
Thank you. I think that's where I'm going.
Okay. Please continue.
All right. So, and then starting on slide 26, the second addendum, are follow-ups from the, moving on to slide 27, these are several follow-ups from our April 15th hearing in the committee, as well as questions that were emailed to the department by both of the co-chairs. And I believe the following set of slides addresses all of the questions that we did receive. So slide 28, we were asked to provide a list of municipalities within the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. This map shows the boundaries of the NPRA as well as the communities. There are four official municipalities within the NPRA. Those are shown here on the map. And then slide 29 gets to the question from Representative Hannon right now. This slide, we were asked to provide information on the state's share of royalties on different land types. But this slide goes a little bit further and also shows which taxes apply on the different land types. So you'll see that production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax, these all apply to all land within the state and out to the 3-mile boundary offshore, regardless of who owns that land. So for tax purposes, it's anything up to the 3-mile boundary for all of the taxes. And then for lease expenditures against production tax, for example, it would be all lease expenditures within that boundary are deductible for production tax purposes. For royalty, that varies by land type. So beyond the 6-mile limit, you're in the federal OCS, federal offshore continental shelf, or OCS, and the federal royalty applies in that area. The state does not receive any share of royalty outside the 6-mile limit. Between 3 and 6 miles, there's a federal royalty that applies, and 27% of that is shared back to the state with no restrictions. So, for instance, the Liberty Field is going to fall into this 3 to 6 mile 8G area. A portion of the federal North Star Field and potentially some other new exploration areas will fall into this category. As mentioned, anything within the state and up to 3 miles where the state is the landowner, we have a state royalty. There's a range of different royalty rates on that. Within the National Petroleum Reserve, there's a federal royalty that applies, and half of that is shared back to the state. There's provisions that half of revenue from NPRA has to be used for the benefit of local communities, so we have an NPRA grant program that applies there. Looking at potential development within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, it's a similar 50% share, currently with no restrictions on how that 50% of ANWR revenue is used. Other federal land in the state has a federal royalty with a 90% share. There's currently no production in that category. And then the last category of land is private land, including land owned by Alaska Native corporations. Those have a private royalty applied to the lease with the private landowner, and the state doesn't receive a direct share of the royalty. However, we do levy a private landowner royalty tax on the value of those royalties under the production tax code, and that amounts to 5% of the value of the royalty for oil, or 1.667% for gas.
Was this slide helpful, Rep. Bannon?
It is. Okay. That answers my questions.
Okay. Thank you.
So slide 30, we were asked to provide the royalty rate for Liberty. And the Liberty Field consists of 3 separate federal leases. They're all at a 12.5% royalty rate. And Alaska would receive 27% of the revenue from those leases as revenue sharing, or 3.375% of the value of production at Liberty. We will not, as the unit is currently structured, we would not receive tax revenue on the unit itself unless the development were to result in a taxable event inside the 3-mile limit. So example would be a pipeline bringing oil on shore would be subject to property tax, and then we'd have potential benefits of the production going through the pipeline and the higher throughput that could potentially reduce tariffs on taps and marine costs. Moving on to slide 31, we were asked to provide additional information about allowable lease expenditures for production tax purposes. Again, getting into this slide, I'll reiterate my disclaimer from earlier in the presentation that I'm an economist and not an auditor, so don't take what I say as tax guidance.
Back on record, please continue.
All right, again, for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. And we're on slide 31 of our presentation now, going through follow-ups from our April 15th hearing. We were asked to provide additional information about what constitutes allowable lease expenditures for the purposes of the oil and gas production tax. So this slide summarizes the lease expenditure statute under AS 4355-165, tries to condense several pages of legalese down into a handful of bullet points here. So allowable lease expenditures are any costs incurred to explore for, develop, or produce oil and gas reserves in the state of Alaska. So these are going to be costs that are incurred upstream of the point of production, which is typically within the lease, ordinary and necessary costs, direct costs of production only. There's a separate allowance for overhead. It's rather than allowing companies to add up their various overhead costs, there's simply a regulation that allows a 4.5% of their direct costs as an overhead allowance. Then companies are also allowed to use potentially any carried forward lease expenditures from a prior year. This is the provision that took effect just this last year, where we eliminated the net operating loss credits and replaced them with a carry forward lease expenditure allowance. The allowable lease expenditures do not include any exclusions under AS 4355-165E. There are 22 specific exclusions to what are allowable lease expenditures. A few examples listed here are lease acquisition costs, financing costs, litigation costs, dismantlement costs, costs of oil spills, lobbying, and there's also a 30% per barrel exclusion from capital costs.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, and Mr. Stickle, I apologize because this really may be an auditor question as I say it out loud. But with the carry forward leased expenditures, if a lease is sold and still had carry forward expenditures, is that sold with the lease?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I believe that's the case. That might be a good one for Director Glover to chime in on.
Are you there, Ms. Glover? She's dropped.
Or we can get back to the committee with confirmation, but I believe that's the case.
A tough question. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think just, you know, there are a lot of the exclusions, and I was looking at a lot of those are more, seems more like on the capital side. But on the operating expenses, I just want to clarify, you know, employee expenses, those are considered allowable lease expenditures. I believe all the salaries and bonuses and things like that, there's no exclusions for those things.
Representative Co-Chair Tarr, as long as those costs fall into the bullet points listed here, being upstream costs, ordinary and necessary, and direct costs of production, yes.
Thank you.
See any other questions? Proceed, please.
Sure. So moving on to slide 32, Mr. Chairman. We were asked to provide additional clarity on how multi-year expenditures are treated in the production tax calculation. And so, again, under AS 4355-165, which defines the lease expenditures, the lease expenditures in a given year are based on when the cost is incurred. And so the costs are allowed in the year that they are incurred for both operating and capital expenditures, which brings us to the question, what does it mean when a cost is incurred? And we actually have a regulation that has a couple pages that lays that out, that clarifies when the cost is incurred. So there's two situations here. If there's one producer that's also the unit operator, then the costs are considered incurred when they are expensed or capitalized for IRS tax accounting purposes. If there's multiple producers, the costs are considered incurred when they're billed to the working interest owners of the unit. And moving on to slide 33, Mr. Chairman, we were asked to provide the components of netback costs, including the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff. And so this table is a standard table that we publish in our fall revenue forecast. We've updated it here for the spring revenue forecast data, and shows the components of the total netback costs, the biggest being the marine transportation charge and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff. Couple notes here. The feeder pipeline tariff is actually a weighted average of all production on the slope, so it includes Prudhoe Bay production, which has no feeder pipeline tariff, as well as production from other fields that might have a higher feeder pipeline tariff than what's shown here. And the quality bank, which is a negative number here, is actually negative due to the impact of refineries in the state that basically offtake the higher value components of the crude oil stream. And so they pay a charge into the quality bank. So what happens is the oil that's produced on the slope is actually a slightly higher quality than what ends up sold on the West Coast.
Mr. Chairman, I just wonder, I mean, I guess that was a pretty good explanation, but we haven't talked about the quality bank at all yet, and so I don't know if you want to say a little bit more about that, just to put it in context.
Sure. Co-Chair Tarr, so the general concept is that there's multiple different fields putting oil into the pipeline, and some of the fields produce a slightly higher quality oil. Some have a slightly lower quality oil. It just has to do with the makeup of the different types of hydrocarbons, sulfur content, things like that. And so all of this gets mixed in the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and then the oil that comes out at the end is a consistent quality across the board. And so there's an accounting mechanism. That's what the quality bank is. And that accounting mechanism provides for payments in or out to account for the fact that somebody took a higher or lower quality crude at the end of the pipeline than they put in at the beginning of the pipeline. That's kind of the concept in a nutshell. And then where the refineries play in is that there's refineries along the pipeline that actually take out some of the higher quality oil. So the oil that is at the upstream of those refineries is a slightly higher quality than the oil that is downstream of those refineries, and they pay into the quality bank for that.
Thank you. Through the chair, two things. First, where are the refineries currently and who are they? And secondly, on that quality bank, from 2018, it's a credit of 17 cents, but we're seeing it go up substantially in this data you're presenting. So I assume that means that the new fields coming online have lower quality oil with more sulfur, et cetera. Am I reading that correctly?
So Representative Hannon, through the chair, in theory, the quality bank, before accounting for the refinery activity, in theory, the net quality bank should be something close to zero. So we can get back with the details on why the quality bank is increasing over time here. And as for the refineries, I know there's refineries in the Fairbanks area.
Well, thank you. Through the chair. And I guess it's the pluralization, because I thought we were down to one refinery. So I'm glad that there's more than one. But if we could find out who they are and where they're operating, because that's just one of those, my ignorance. I thought we were down to one refinery. So it's good to know that we have more than one.
Sure. Representative Hannon, through the chair. And if I was mistaken in the pluralization, I apologize. But we will get back with the details on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Rip Tellerico?
It's PetroStar in North Pole. Yeah. PetroStar. You can Google it. It'll pop up.
I believe you, Dave.
Representative Hopkins?
Thank you. So the marine costs and the TAPS tariff being the vast majority of the transportation costs, that are those are deducted based on what we talked about last week, correct? So if is that TAPS tariff consistent for all producers and shippers down the pipeline?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, each owner of TAPS sets their own tariff. So the tariffs claimed by the different companies are actually slightly different. This represents a weighted average of all of the companies.
Follow up. So for the three owners of TAPS, they're able to they pay that tariff and they're able to deduct it. They're paying themselves that tariff and they're able to deduct it. A company like Hillcorp or somebody who's not one of the owners of TAPS, is they still deduct it, but they're paying the three owners whatever tariff they charge, correct?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, that's correct. And there's actually four owners of the pipeline right now. So, yeah, in that example, if the company was not one of the owners, they would pay the tariff to one of the other owners. We do have a slide coming up in a couple slides that provides a little more discussion on TAPS.
I'll skip it.
Co-Chair Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doing some math here. So the one exception, and I just love to nerd out on these kind of charts here, would be on the if we look at the feeder tariff line. So say, for example, Point Thompson, you know, that's where that number would be quite a bit larger for the expense of the feeder lines coming into TAPS. And I guess I just want to bring that point up and see if you can comment on it, because, like, when we talk about the Liberty Project or some of these other developments, you know, we have to think about the whole cost of that, because a big piece of that for the more far away locations would just be a feeder line to get into the TAP system. So so that has a big influence, as I understand it, on the likelihood of some of those projects being developed.
Co-Chair Tarr, that's correct. We do expect a lot of the new production to have a higher feeder pipeline tariff than what's shown here.
And if I could follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do you have, by chance, in the top of your head, the amount that number is for Point Thompson? I feel like it's like $6 or $8 even, or something like that. I feel like it's pretty high because it makes it almost double, I want to say.
Yeah, Co-Chair Tarr, I want to put that number in the it's between $10 and $20 is the current Point Thompson feeder pipeline tariff, and we actually prepared that as a response for a previous committee or response, and so we have all of that information laid out, and we'll provide that to this committee as well.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
So moving on to slide 34, Mr. Chairman, we were asked a few questions basically asking us to provide some additional information about feeder pipelines and the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So one of the questions was, do the companies own and maintain feeder pipelines? And so the way it works is the feeder pipelines are actually owned, operated, and maintained by independent pipeline companies. In many cases, the same parent company for a oil producer also owns a share of the pipeline company, but that's not always the case. Feeder pipeline tariffs are regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And those regulatory bodies dictate the cost structure of the tariff, which is how the pipeline company can recoup their cost of investment and earn a reasonable rate of return. And there are rules that a pipeline carrier cannot discriminate between shippers. So they do need to allow a third-party shipper on the pipeline under the same provisions as an affiliated shipper.
Representative Hopkins?
Yeah, thank you. And maybe you would answer this in Representative Tarr's question on the previous slide. The reason that Point Thompson feeder tariff is so high, is it based on distance from the pipeline or the central processing facility that it has to get to, or why is that $10 to $20?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, there's two reasons I would cite for that. One is the distance, as you mentioned. The oil's going a long way from Point Thompson to the rest of the North Slope infrastructure. And the second reason is that production at Point Thompson is fairly low currently,
okay,
compared to the potential capacity that could come out of that field if there's a major gas sale.
Cool question. Follow-up. So it's just that there's currently less resources going through those feeder lines to spread that cost around for the lines, or for maintaining those lines in the tariff?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Tarr, and I also want to mention that Representative Johnson has joined us. Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That last bullet point, I just wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more, because one of the things I've heard in the past is that inability to get a product, you know, into the tap system is one of the challenges for smaller operators, and that they're, you know, basically getting into this existing infrastructure. And so I'm just thinking, even if you can't discriminate, I guess, do we have a system that, because of the way it's the net profits tax, you know, if you're the company that builds the line, you have the tax benefit at least of writing off the expense associated with that, versus another company, you would just, you know, be subject to, I guess, even if it is the true cost of it, because you don't have a way to write it off. Is that really what then, like, limits the economics of it, if it can't otherwise be, you know, disproportionate to those other companies?
Yeah, Representative Co-Chair Tarr, when we're talking about feeder pipelines, there's a distinction to be made between a feeder pipeline and a gathering line.
Mm-hmm.
So a gathering line would be a pipeline upstream of the point of production on the lease that gets oil from the wells to the ultimate production facilities on the lease. The costs of developing those gathering lines are allowable for lease expenditure purposes against the production tax. A feeder pipeline is considered to be downstream of the point of production. So this is not going to be an immediately deductible cost of building a feeder pipeline for production tax purposes. The way the costs of building those feeder pipelines will be recouped is through the tariff that gets deducted over time, and that's a regulated cost. So in theory, for a given feeder pipeline, the companies putting oil into that line should be facing a similar situation.
Okay.
And so if I may move on to slide 35, Mr. Chairman. This is also talking about pipelines and the question of what portion of the transportation fees for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System go to Alyeska, which is the pipeline operator, for maintenance and operation purposes, versus what percentage goes to the four TAPS owners. And so what we've done here is pulled out some information from our revenue forecast. These are based on our spring forecast of TAPS tariff. These are projections in our internal modeling to illustrate the relative magnitudes of the costs, not based on any statement from industry or the operators as to what they expect. But for calendar year 2020, our forecast projects a $973 million total cost of service for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Of that, about $700 million is the direct operating expense, which is about 72%. $131 million is a return on the rate base to the owners, which is about 13% of the total cost. And $143 million represents other items such as depreciation, state income tax, things like that, which is 15% of the total costs. So the costs that are included in the tariff are primarily the costs paid to Alyeska to operate and maintain the pipeline system, but also represents recoupment of costs incurred by the owners. And so, as I mentioned earlier, the last bullet here just states that each TAPS owner sets its own tariff, which is subject to regulation by the two regulatory agencies. And so there are currently four owners of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, three of which that are active carriers. Moving on to slide 36, we were asked to provide information about effective production tax rates since enactment of Senate Bill 21. So this slide shows our estimated effective tax rate at a range of prices for fiscal year 2020. This is a standard analysis that we present every year, and it's been updated for the spring revenue forecast. In this slide, we estimate effective tax rate based on aggregated data, again, for non-GVR eligible production. And the effective tax rate is calculated as tax after taxable barrel credits divided by total production tax value. And in fiscal year 2020, the effective tax rate on non-GVR oil is estimated at about 8% based on this aggregated analysis. So it's interesting to look at the shape of the curve here on slide 36. You'll notice once you get to ANS prices below about $65 per barrel, the companies are paying based on the gross minimum tax, and the state takes a relatively higher share of profit at those lower prices. And then once we go above $65 per barrel, the state takes a relatively higher share of profit as the net tax kicks in and the tax increases. So there's this crossover point right in the $65 to $66 per barrel range where the effective tax rate is about 8%, and we happen to be right at that crossover point currently.
Representative Hopkins?
So, well, oil closed, ANS closed on April 18th at 72. The estimated, and I think this is what you just said, the estimated effective tax rate at what the revenue source book expects it to be is the lowest point of the tax scheme for us.
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, that's correct. In terms of effective tax rate on production tax value, at our forecast, it's about 8%. If oil prices were to average in the low 70s for fiscal year 2020, it would be in the 10 to 15% range.
Thank you.
So moving on to slide 37, Mr. Chairman, this gets at the actual question that was asked. So what we've done here is we've taken the same methodology for modeling the effective tax rate for a typical non-GVR field, and we've applied that backwards for the last 4.5 years through since the enactment of Senate Bill 21. And it's interesting to note the relationship between the effective tax rate and the ANS price. So in fiscal year 18, the effective production tax rate was about 8%. Again, in fiscal year 18, we were right around that gross to net tax crossover point. In fiscal year 14, right after Senate Bill 21 took effect, we had a higher effective tax rate due to higher profits and higher prices and some progressive elements in the tax system. Then looking at fiscal year 16 was the other year that we had a higher effective production tax rate. But in fiscal year 16, it was due to a gross tax and much lower profits and prices. So we have 2 years of net tax, which are fiscal year 14 and 15. We have 2 years of gross tax, which were fiscal year 16 and 17, and then fiscal year 18, where we're right at that crossover. And the average effective tax rate over this time frame was about 24%.
Co-Chair Char.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's hard for me to sort of like look at this slide and then not want to talk about it a little bit more, because I think one of the things that's illustrated on this slide and has been my multi-year effort that has not been successful yet is just it tells one of the story of how closely our tax system is linked to the price per barrel. And when we've worked with our consultants, they've consistently said, you know, that is the wrong way to do this. And that's why you see such fluctuation. And I think, I mean, represented here, because if you look at the years, the earlier years there where, and keeping in mind that the calendar year is offset of the fiscal year, but that, you know, when the prices were high, there was a lot more spending happening. But then when the prices tanked, which would have been the fall of 2014, but you'd be in fiscal year 15, you know, it takes a while for the companies to sort of slow down operations, lay people off. So then you see sort of that gradual slide, you know, to sort of equilibrate to the lower prices and then sort of adjust to the new normal. But it's just this weird sort of like offset to the actual price per barrel at the time that you're looking at, because there's a lag in time of the activity of the companies. Is that, you know, what you think when you look at those numbers? I mean, that's what I feel like the story being told by those numbers is.
Co-chair Tarr, so you're correct that spending has been reduced in recent years as a response to lower oil prices. I would go back to slide 36, and it's, you know, there's a fundamental structure to the production tax system where we've made a policy choice to take a higher share of profits at certain prices and certain profitability levels and a lower share at others. And that's a policy decision.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. But I guess when you look at what happened in FY 2016, I think, you know, if the contraction could happen more quickly, then would have tried to reduce like lease expenditures more quickly. So I think that overall effective tax rate would have stayed lower. But I guess that's where I'm going with that sort of time lag and the way that things are so linked to price as being something that we could reevaluate, because it wouldn't be such great intervals as the price has changed. Do you think that is something to think about, or
Co-Chair Tarr, that would be, you know, that's a policy decision. You're correct that the price of oil has a tremendous impact on us as well as the producers. Fiscal year 16 was a very challenging year. A lot of the companies lost money.
Mm-hmm.
And the 61% effective tax rate here in fiscal year 16 represents only production tax mm-hmm. as a share of the production tax value. And as we'll actually see in a couple slides further, when you factor in the other elements of government take, the state share was even higher than this. So moving on to slide 38, Mr. Chairman, this is the next iteration of analysis that I was just alluding to. In addition to effective tax rate, we were asked to provide information about total state take since the enactment of Senate Bill 21. And so this chart here on this slide 38 shows the two barrel charts from earlier in the presentation that show the distribution of the share of profits for fiscal year 2020 for a typical non-GVR field, and then for a industry-wide analysis with all production and costs. And slide 39 uses the same methodology to estimate the share of cash flows for a typical non-GVR field and for slope-wide for the last 5 years. Again, these are modeled numbers using that same methodology. For fiscal year 14 and 15, we had a fairly similar, so maybe I'll just step back and explain this table a little bit. So we have, again, the five fiscal years, we have the ANS price, and we have two sets of analysis. On the left is the state, municipal, federal, and producer take as a share of profits for each of those years for the typical non-GVR field, and then the right-hand set of columns is for slope-wide with all production and costs included. And then on the bottom, we've calculated an average over the 5 years for each of those metrics. So in fiscal year 14 and 15, we had a similar government producer take split as was envisioned when Senate Bill 21 was debated, with a government take in the low to mid 60s and a producer take in the 30% range. In fiscal year 2016, we had the aforementioned lower prices, and the state and municipalities took almost all of the cash flow, with the royalty, production tax, and property tax all having fixed or gross basis. And if you include the exploration and development costs that the industry was still making during that time frame, the state actually took over 100% of the cash flow and profit generated on the slope in fiscal year 16. In fiscal year 17, we had some recovery in prices off of the lows, much lower spending, as Co-Chair Tarr mentioned earlier. The major producers were able to make some profit in fiscal year 17, and we reverted to that split of government take in the 60s and producer take in the 30s. In fiscal year 18, we saw a fairly low production tax revenue. Again, that was a function of exactly where we were on that effective tax rate curve. And we also saw reduced corporate income taxes both at the federal level. The tax change took effect halfway through fiscal year 2018. And those the combination of the lower production tax and the reduced federal corporate tax allowed the producer take to increase a little bit in fiscal year 2018. And that is the last of the slides I have in this slide deck, Mr. Chairman.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this, could you add in one more column and share it with us if you pull out the royalty? Because this is sort of a point of tension, I would say, that sometimes the royalty is considered, you know, part of the state take, but I don't, in my opinion, you know, because it's the portion that we're maintaining ownership of, it's not really part of what the company isn't getting. So I think it should be pulled out. Could you pull that out of that, you know, instead of just having the state and muni, pull that out so we could separate what represents royalty versus what represents production tax?
Co-Chair Tarr, we can do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I think that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, do we have another minute?
Yeah.
Or no, just going back to the earlier slides, because I think I had a question. Apologies that I don't have it pulled up here. When I had said that, you know, so many things linked to the price per barrel, the vice chair had sent a note, and I guess I'll just mention this in case this comes up and we talk about it a little bit more. But if folks look at slide 11, when we had worked with consultants, there was a suggestion made to consider working off of the production tax value. And the way it was described was, if you want to have a true net profit system, then the production tax value represents the value once all the expenditures have been deducted. So the transportation, the operating, and then the capital lease expenditures, and then would tax off of that value. And I don't know if the department is evaluating any of these other options at this time, or if we're just sort of operating status quo for now.
Co-Chair Tarr, that might be a comment better addressed by the commissioner.
Okay. He's available.
Are you online, Commissioner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Commissioner Bruce Tangeman calling in for the record.
Did you hear the question from Co-Chair Tarr?
If she could repeat it, I'd appreciate it greatly.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Thank you, Commissioner. I just mentioned on an earlier slide, kind of in my mind when I'm looking at these, I'm just thinking of what we've done over the last few years and things that we've worked on. And one of the things that had come up is that we have a system that's where so many of the levers are linked to the price per barrel. And because of the volatility in the price, it means just a lot of volatility in the revenue, but also makes it harder to predict. And that one thing we might consider is instead looking at if we want to maintain a true net profit system, taxing off of the production tax value. And so that would represent, you know, the true net system, because it would allow for the transportation, operating, and capital expenditures to have been deducted before applying the tax. And that way it wouldn't matter if it was something like Point Thompson that was really expensive, or you know, something like a development that's closer to existing infrastructure that was less expensive. Those things would be captured through the expenditures, and so the PTV would better reflect that. And I just wonder if the department at this time is looking into any of the work done by those consultants or any of those suggestions. One of the reasons it's appealing to me, frankly, is that as I've studied this over these last 7 years, we're constantly in these audit. It's an ongoing audit problem, and as I understand it, one of the challenges in the audits is going through the verify the allowable lease expenditures and some of these things that have been suggested, if it was simplified or you know, kind of could be done in a way that would make it easier for us to administer. And I just wonder if the department is considering that at this time, or if it's worth us working on in committee.
Madam Co-Chair Tarr, there were several questions in there, and as you are well aware, this is a complex issue, and there are a lot of questions. I understand that. The first one about the audit problem that you stated. The biggest issue is that we changed the tax structure so many times over such a short period of time that we were auditing several different tax structures back to back to back. So that in and of itself slows down the entire problem. Now that we've been under a consistent, stable tax regime for the last several years, we do have a plan to catch up, and we are seeing the fruits of those plans to catch up and get on a three-year audit schedule. So that's a positive sign. I think your general question was, you know, is Department of Revenue exploring issues, changes, possible corrections? I think from a policy perspective, the question number one should be, will a change put more oil in the pipeline? I think when we went from ACES to SB21, we saw that happen. We saw increased production in back-to-back years for the first time in 30 years, I believe. And now we're seeing flat production and stable production for the next decade. So when it comes to the goal, I think all of our goal in the state should be a stable, predictable, competitive tax regime. And I think that's what we see right now. We've got some states that we compete with, such as Texas, California, Colorado, New Mexico. They haven't made a single change to their tax structure since 2004. So that's who we compete with, and we compete with them at low prices and high prices. So I don't think our structure is as much pegged to the price of oil. I think all our competitors are competing for investment at various oil prices. So that's kind of the fine line, or the needle we all try to thread, is to put a structure in place and then let it do what it needs to do to draw investment to the state. And I think we've seen the benefit of that the last several years.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions from the committee? Does that conclude your presentation?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for spending a couple days with us and providing that presentation. I look forward to some of the follow-up that came out of this meeting as well. And we'll take a brief at ease as we set up for our next item on the agenda, which is House Bill 122. going to take a second. I forgot to thank Mrs. Debbie Tillinghast and our LIO moderator, Eric Heimbigner, for their help today. Our next order of business is House Bill 122 by Representative Hannon relating to the Funter Bay Marine Park Unit and protecting its social and historical significance related to the Unungan Cemetery in Funter Bay. This is the second hearing on 122. We heard invited and public testimony in the first hearing. And we'd like to thank Rep. Hannon and your staff for reaching out to the co-chair's offices for clarifying some questions that were raised last week. We have not received any amendments from committee members on 122, and it is our intention to take final action on this bill today. Representative Hannon, thanks for joining us at the table. Please state your name and provide any comments you have on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Sarah Hannon. The first thing I want to do is make sure we're correct, because in your packets you have a memo dated May 16th, which has not yet happened, and that should be corrected and dated April 16th, and that does address most of the questions we think were raised in the first committee hearing. And then I'll draw your attention to it, yet another version of a map, which for me as a visual learner, and it should be a highlighted copy in front of you, perhaps gives a better clarity as to why the portion that was selected to be added in is added in. So if you have that in front of you, in the bold outline is the currently existing parcels that make up the Funter Bay State Marine Park, and you can see that most of the acreage is in the water with a partial a portion coming into Coot Cove. And to the right of that are two other three portions on the right side of the bay, that would actually be the east, that are not going to be added in into making the rest of it contiguous. But the part that says Funter, it is highlighted in yellow. The cemetery is just below the F on Funter. So in the other versions of the maps where we've given you a closer input, the cemetery lies in the front of that F and Funter on the land. And the acreage that was proposed from DNR to add in would give them a contiguous parcel. So instead of just carving out the beachfront of that to add in the cemetery, their recommendation was to add in that whole square. And then the Ledge Island, the island out in the middle, is an island that is Ledge Island because at sometimes it's completely underwater. It's not always above water. It's one of those classic bays where some of the islands in Funter Bay are known navigational hazards, but they would add that island that is largely below tide line into the marine park. And with that, I do think in writing we address the questions and concerns we heard from the committee.
Any other questions from the committee members? Seeing none, Co-Chair Tarr.
Okay. Sounds really good. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 122, labeled 31-LS0637, /U, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there an objection? Seeing none, the bill moves from committee, and we'll take a minute after we adjourn to fill out the committee report.
Thank you.
Our next meeting is this Wednesday, April 24. The committee will hear a presentation on fisheries taxes in Alaska by DOR and hear an update on the commercial fishing industry in Alaska. Also hearing House Resolution 8, International Year of the Salmon by Rep. Tarr. And with no further business before the committee, we will adjourn at 2:10 p.m.